Everybody all right? Who's not okay? That's good. We got a few honest people. My name's John Allred, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm glad. I really want to thank everybody in the committee and the whole conference. It's just been wonderful. And I'll tell you, the speakers have been great, haven't they? I mean, I'm ready. I'm ready to go home right now. You know, my cup's full. And I'm always amazed. It amazes me when people invite me to come to a roundup and share, you know, because I don't do this very good. And I don't do Alcoholics Anonymous very good. You know, I want to put, you know, disclosure, they always read, a lot of times they'll read the disclosure and it says, if you can't reconcile what the guy says, just with the big book, just disregard it. And I got a little disclosure that I want everybody to make sure. See, I don't do, as I said, I don't do AA very good. And I don't know anybody that does. That's the incredible thing about it. You know, in the meeting after the meeting, when you're out there having coffee and you're trying to help another alcoholic, who's usually not there, you know. And you're just talking about them a little bit, you know. And somebody inevitably say what you said, you know. Oh, yeah, he talks the talk, but he can't walk the walk, right? Shit, who are we kidding? You know, none of us can walk the walk. I mean, if I could walk the walk, I wouldn't need to come to AA. You know, I come here because I can't walk the walk. And I think that's what the book says, doesn't it? Then when they read How It Works, you get through reading How It Works, what does the book say? It says, wow, what an order. Can't go through with it, you know. Don't be discouraged. No one. See, they don't exclude anybody. They don't exclude Bill Wilson. They don't exclude Dr. Bob. They certainly don't exclude John Allred. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like. You know what that means? Maintain anything like? We haven't even come close. Okay? Perfect adherence to these principles. Nobody can do this deal. You know? And yet those of us that can't, like talk about those of you that can't. Well, I don't do it better than he doesn't do it. I really enjoyed the... This deal really is a disease of perception. And all the speakers have talked about that distorted perception of reality that we got, you know? And it's really amazing how distorting... Yeah, I'm sitting out there in a convention in California. And right next to this big convention, thousands of people. And right next to that, where they're having the convention, there's this mall attached to it, right? And so I'm out there on Saturday afternoon. I'm just eating some frozen yogurt. People watching, you know, it's a lot of fun. And I see these punk rockers. Okay, you got punk rockers out here in Arkansas? Okay? No, you haven't got them here. You've seen them on TV, all right? Anyway, and they're in the convention, right? Because they got their name badges on. They're alcoholics. They got their name badges on. There's this girl and boy walking. They're just really punked out. Now, the guy's got a pink spike going out this way. And he's got a green spike going straight up in the air. And he's got a purple spike going out this way. And they're walking along just in love, holding hands. Dressed, I don't know, kind of like the way he's dressed when he lived under the bridge, you know? And they're walking along there, and I'm sitting there watching them. And right next to me is this sunglass boutique. All they sell in there are sunglasses, right? Guy goes over, puts on these sunglasses. His girlfriend says, take those off. They make you look stupid. You know, just distorted perception of reality, you know? And we're not the only ones that got that. You know, those normies got it. Right next to the sunglass boutique's this earring joint. Oh, they got accessories and earrings and stuff. They got a big sign up in the window. It says, ears pierce while you wait. I mean, what's the alternative to that? You know? just a distorted perception of reality. We got that in Dallas. We got it down. They got a big deal down there. Go on. Word, officer. We can talk about this. They got a new, these new little shops, these little condom boutiques. Okay? We got one down there called Condoms to Go. You can't use them there. You know? Come get you. You know, it's just distorted perception of reality. I'm sitting there in a meeting, my home group, and they're having, this was years ago, and they're having some discussion. I don't know what they were talking about. This little lady, Sharon, she's talking about how grateful she is to Betty Ford. Because Betty Ford had come out, and as this was years ago, and she had set up that joint out there in California for treatment, and what a great benefit that was. I mean, if the first lady could come out and be alcoholic, maybe that helped a lot of people thinking, well, maybe I'm alcoholic. I'm sitting there listening to this, and I just started to laugh, okay? Because it dawned on me, you know, if it's true what they say, that the Al-Anons are as sick, if not sicker, than the alcoholics. No wonder our country got so screwed up. I mean, we had an untreated Al-Anon running the thing. Unbelievable. That could happen, you know? And it was a typical alcoholic Al-Anon relationship, wasn't it, you know? Betty does all the drinking, Jerry does all the falling down, you know? Unbelievable. Just distorted perception of what's going on in this world, you know? I got that problem. I got that problem. It's not my fault, okay? I'm an adult child of non-alcoholics. That's a bummer, man. I got nobody to blame, you know? I did all the drinking. I did all the drinking in my family. Nobody drank in my family. My mom doesn't drink, brother doesn't drink, dad doesn't drink. Sisters don't drink. I didn't drink growing up. I grew up in a very normal environment, you know? It was a great childhood growing up. You know, we never moved in the middle of the night, you know? Dad never beat Mom. You know, we just grew up in a very normal, middle-income American environment. Really kind of a boring deal for a guy like me, you know? I went to college just like you're supposed to go to college. Got married my senior year in college just like you're supposed to get married, you know? Went in the insurance business in Salt Lake City. Never drank. Never smoked. Started in the insurance business. Things were pretty good. I was scared. I was scared to death. You know? I'd come in the office in the morning. It'd be a stack of messages. My secretary would give me these phone messages. I say, what are these? Those are phone messages. Who from? I don't know. What do you think they want? I guess they want to buy some insurance. Think from me, you know? Man, scary deal. Phones are scary. Aren't phones scary? You know, hey, ring, 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 ring. Who is it? You know? I knew who it was. Them, you know. Ran into a buddy of mine named Stuart. Stuart drank, so I started hanging out in the bar with Stuart. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on my drunk life, but I loved them. I was a bar drinker. I really was. I'd hang out in the bar with Stuart, and I'd drink water for a long time. Never drank. But I loved the bar. Love everything about the bar, you know. I'm a bar drinker. I like to take my act on the road and sure be what an ass I can be, you know. Just love that kind of thing. I always get dressed up. I go out drinking when I just started. I'd get dressed up and go out drinking in the bar, you know. Insanity, that was my sponsor pointed out. I was always getting dressed up to go to jail, you know. Crazy. Well, I love bars. You know, I like everything about bars. I just really do. Drank very little at home. I like drinking the bar. I like all bars. I like dark bars, you know. Those dark, stinky bars. I love those bars, you know. I like fern bars, you know, those New York fern bars that are bright and got ferns in. I like those. I like cowboy bars. I really like sawdust on the floor and all that crap. I like biker bars, you know, they're a lot of fun. They're a lot of fun. Like, I never been in a bar I didn't like, you know. It's just like, you know, that experience, you hear a lot of people talking about coming to AA and their home, you know. That's the way I feel when I walk in a bar. Oh, thank God I'm here, you know. Just wonderful. I like bars. And never drank in the bar. Finally, when my second child was born, I had my first drunk. Stuart called me up, congratulated me. He said, we're going out drinking tonight. And I said, great. I said, I'll celebrate. The wife's, you know, in the hospital with this newborn. And I got my other son at grandma's house. So I got all night. We'll go out. So I go out and had my first drunk. And God, it was a great drunk. It was a great drunk. You got to be a member of a private club in Utah to do any drinking. So we got to this private club called the Winery. It's right across from the Salt Palace. We walked down these steps. Walked in there, man. Lights are flashing. They got a live band going on in there. They got women in there, and I had my first drunk. It was a great drunk. You know, I don't know what I drank. I just drank whatever they put in front of me. They bring a drink over. Drink's dark. Dark drink. Got a cherry in it. Just drink it down. You know, next drink, they bring light-colored drink. Got a twist around it. Just drink it down. Just drink whatever they put in it. I had a great drunk. Danced all night. God night. Danced with two lesbians. Well, you know, they were out there dancing together. And I thought, probably want me to join them. I go out there dancing. Then they left together, you know, and there I was alone, you know. You know what? I learned something, though. You're drunk, there's no rejection. You're just drunk. Walked back over to the table, sat down, had the next drink sitting in front of me. Really pretty good. And got up the next morning, no hangover, really felt pretty good. I call up Stuart, and I said, Stuart, I had a ball. I had a great night. He said, yeah, you did. You did. I said, Stuart, do you think you may go have a drink tonight? He said, I don't know. I hadn't thought about it. I'd probably stop by and have one. I said, what time? He said, I got to work till 3 o'clock this afternoon. I said, well, why don't I meet you about 3:30? You know? So I meet him at 3:30, and I never drank socially. I never drank socially. I never got the cocktail or the glass of wine or the champagne and walked around the deal and social. I like to drink to get drunk. That's what I do. I just like to drink to get drunk. And I'm getting in all kinds of trouble immediately. I mean, I got a lot of problems going on immediately. And in fact, it really ticked me off. I'd only been drinking 6 months. I got my first DWI. You know, and that really was a bummer because I had read at that time, you know, the mothers were just organizing themselves against drunk drivers, and they were really mad at us. And they were publishing a lot of stuff and coming down on the lawn. I'd read, and they had an article in the newspaper I'd read where they said only 1 in 2,000 drunk drivers ever get picked up. And I thought, whew, I can drink years. If I get drunk every night, I can go 5-6 years before I need to worry about getting picked up. 6 months I get busted for drunk driving. I thought, gee, many creepers. And then I thought, well, I guess that's good. Because now I've got like 15 years for my next ticket, you know? So it won't be a problem, you know? I'm getting in trouble immediately. People starting to tell me that I'm an alcoholic. I mean, I haven't been drinking a year, and they're starting to tell me that I'm drinking alcoholic. And I'd say, well, what's an alcoholic? How do you know you're an alcoholic? What is that? They give you all that stuff telling you it's a disease and everything. And I read that. I say, okay, then if it's a disease, let's go to the doctor. You know, let's prove it. You know, can you want to take physical? Well, that won't do any good. Well, then how do you know you're an alcoholic? What's an alcoholic? You want to take some blood? You know, you got to be able to do some blood analysis, run it to a blood analysis machine, come out and say, yeah, well, we got the results of your test back, and You're alcoholic. No, we can't do that. Well, how do you know you're an alcoholic? What's an alcoholic? How do you know that? You want to do an MRI or a CAT scan or something? Got to be some way to verify this. No, we can't. Oh, yeah. See, here's the deal. Y'all want me to quit drinking. What happens 20 years from now? I find out I'm non-alcoholic. I've grown 20 years. I could have been drinking. I'm not willing to take that risk. And they say, well, they give you that test, you know? They give you that funky little test with those 20 questions on it. I want you to know I can take that test and pass it, non-alcoholic. Okay, because I did it 3 times. You know, because I like to lie. You know, it's just that simple. I'm so good at lying, I don't know I'm lying. It's that perception of reality. You know. Finally, they said, well, John, you know, you drink too much. And as soon as they told me I drank too much, I knew I wasn't an alcoholic. Okay? Because I never drank too much in my life. Ever. There's not an alcoholic in this room, if you're an alcoholic, that ever drank too much. You know, it's impossible for an alcoholic to drink too much. You can't do it. See, I am an alcoholic. Not because I drank too much. I'm an alcoholic because I couldn't drink enough. And if you can't drink enough, it's impossible to drink too much. Never happened. You ever drink enough in your life? I mean, yeah, I can see somebody from this room. You go into the bar, sit down, have a couple cocktails. Bartender says, you care for another cocktail? Oh, golly. I think I've had enough. I got a big day tomorrow. Don't want to mess up. I've had enough. Never had enough, you know? Can't drink. I mean, I go to the bar, get drunk, blackout, get in a wreck, go to jail. What happens when you get out of jail? Make you thirsty being locked up like that. Yeah. Just having enough. I go to the bar with Stuart at noon. We start drinking at noon. It's midnight. Okay? We've been drinking 12 hours in this place, and we're drunk, and we know we're drunk, and we're talking about it.
Stuart, I am so drunk. He says, me too. You buy another drink?
Hadn't had enough. Well, if you can't drink enough, it's impossible to drink too much. See, normal drinkers can drink enough. So occasionally, but not very often, they might drink too much. But if you're an alcoholic like I'm an alcoholic and you can't drink enough, you'll never drink too much. And when they tell me you drink too much, then I know I'm not an alcoholic. You know, because I can't drink enough. That's my problem. In fact, when I drink, it's incredible what happens when I drink. When I drink, I'm okay. When I drink every time, then I feel comfortable. In fact, I feel happy, joyous, and free. When I'm sober and I'm not drinking, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. And you want to take that away from me? When the only time I'm really feeling good and I'm really happy, joyous, and free is when I'm drinking. And when I'm not, I'm scared to death. You know? In fact, when I drink, it's just a magical deal that happens. Every time, never fails. It's like those promises, you know, at the end of step 9. When I'm drinking, those promises come true in my life. Every one of them works in my life when I'm drinking. I don't know about you, but I'd go to the bar and after that first drink, I don't know, I would kind of begin to sense a new freedom and a new happiness. You know? And then after about that third drink, I don't know about you, but that all that fear of financial insecurity just kind of slipped away. And I was all right. And after about 5-6 drinks, I don't know, I just kind of intuitively used to know how to handle situations that would baffle me, you know? It always works in my... You want to take those promises away from me? Come on! That's what works, you know? That's what works for me. Now I want to tell you something. If I don't find a way to have those promises come true in my life today without drinking alcohol, I will drink alcohol today. I will drink it today. No problem. Because I have to to have those, see? I got to have that. And alcohol, after about 12 drinks, started to do for me what I couldn't do for myself. You know? It was an incredible deal. You want to take all that away from me. Now, I got a lot of problems. Alcohol wasn't one of them. Just flat wasn't one of them. You know? I had problems at work. I had problems at home. I had all that stuff. Finally, I figured out my real problem. See, Utah's at a high altitude. It's up in the mountains. It really is. It's right up there in the mountains. Scientific fact, people who live at high altitudes for prolonged periods of time have thinner blood than people that live at low altitudes. Okay? Well, I've been living in Utah my whole life. I got to have thin blood. You party hard on thin blood, you have a problem. What I really need to do is get to sea level. Okay? Stick it on my blood a little bit. I'd be okay. You know? So I called a buddy of mine who lived in Seattle. I'm talking to him in Seattle. I'm telling about all these problems I got. He says, man, why don't you take a year off, come up here, you can stay with me and Gail and kind of just put your life back together. I said, well, I don't want to really impose on you and Gail and, you know, your five kids. He said, no imposition. I said, I'll be there Tuesday, you know. So I moved to Seattle. And I'm living up in Seattle. I'm not doing anything up there. I'm just doing a little drinking. Working on thickening up my blood. And when you're in that kind of situation and you're not working, the next logical thing you're going to want to do, hell, you're going to want to gamble. You know, it's the best time to gamble is when you're unemployed. And so they had poker parlors up there. There they go, start playing poker. And then if you're a hot shot and a high flyer like me, you want to be where the real action is. So I started running down to Nevada playing the casinos. Finally, I thought, who am I kidding? And I might as well just move to Nevada. So I moved down to Nevada, bounced around Nevada, ended up in Reno, Nevada. And I wasn't doing anything in Reno. I'm just doing a little drinking, playing a little poker, working on thickening up my blood. And an old drinking buddy of mine called from Salt Lake, invited me to come over to Salt Lake. Shouldn't have gone. Doing real good in Reno. But I go over to Salt Lake and meet them. We went out to a place called the One More Time Club. And I found her. She was sitting at the bar waiting, you know. I knew she'd be there. Fell in love. I want to take her out Saturday. She couldn't go out Saturday. Couldn't go out Sunday. I had to stay till Monday. Supposed to go home Sunday. Should have gone home Sunday. Okay? Stay till Monday. And we go out. That Monday, by the way, was October 6, 1981. And we got on this day. It's a bad deal. It's a real bad deal, you know. You know you got a bad deal when you invite them to go to dinner. And then they really want to eat. It's a bad deal. So she's eating and I'm drinking, okay? Well, I'm a gentleman, so every time I order me a whiskey, I order her a glass of wine. Well, the woman ain't keeping up. It's starting to stack up on her, you know. Now, to keep from being embarrassed, I got to drink my whiskey and drink her wine. You know? And it was just a bad deal. She got through eating. She says, I want to go home. So took her home and went down. I knocked on Price's door. I was staying with Price that night, a friend of mine. He opens the door. It's 10:30. He said, I thought you had a date. And I said, that damn woman. I went in there and I had a gallon of wine I drank that night. I said, now tomorrow night, we're going to get after it. You know, I'm going to hit this town one more time, then I got to get out of here. This high altitude drinking is going to get me in trouble. And so we go out Tuesday, October 7, 1981. And we started at noon, and then we went over to see the Fast Show at the Hilton. Then after the show, I remember the show, and then I blacked out a lot. I blacked out an awful lot. And came out of my blackout, and the cops had found me one more time. They wanted my driver's license. I didn't have a driver's license. You know, they had taken that 3 DWIs earlier, you know, so I didn't have a driver's license. And I'm just trying to explain to that cop, listen, I'll just leave my car parked here. I'm glad to stop. I'll leave it parked here. I'm just going right over here. I'm just going to walk right over there. I'll pick it up in the morning. No problem. Well, let's lock it up. And he kept insisting. Finally, ran my license plate, found out who it was. Arrested me, you know. And I'm in jail. And this time, they're pissed. Okay? Because I can't even post bond. I can't even post bond to get out. They said, no. See, I knew the system. I knew the deal. You get arrested, you plead not guilty, right? No matter what you're arrested for, you just plead not guilty. And then you go to the OR lady, and if it was just drunk stuff back then, you get out on your OR. I think the biggest bond I ever posted was $50. And then you get you an attorney. They set a court date. You get your attorney, and then you start that postponing process, right? And you postpone, and you postpone, and you postpone until you can no longer postpone. And then when you got to go to court, and you're going to go to court tomorrow, and the attorney says, no, can't postpone anymore, we go to court tomorrow, then you want to be sure, and the day before you go to court, move. You know? That's what I did. You know, I never went to court, I just moved. And so I had a lot of failure to appear. And they said, no, we're not letting you out, you don't come back. You know? So I'm in jail, and I don't like jail. I don't like lockup. I don't know anybody that likes lockup. I want out, can't get out. Finally, a buddy of mine comes down and sees me, named Stan. Stan's not an alcoholic, doesn't know anything about AA. He comes down and he says, I've talked to some friends, and we think we can get you out. But he says, the only way I'll do that is if you promise me you'll go to treatment, because you're sick and you need help. And I said, oh, Stan, bless you. You are so right. I don't know what it is, man. It's just this overwhelming compulsion comes over me, and like it drags me down in there, and I get drunk, and I get in all kinds of trouble, and I don't want... I guess I'm an alcoholic, Stan, and I need help, but I can't get any in here. He says, we'll get you out. So I get out of jail. Now, I had no intention of not drinking, okay? I didn't want to quit. I wasn't going to quit. I'm just getting out of jail. And I'll do or say anything to get out of jail, right? So I had to stay with Stan. And I got up the next morning. He threw me the yellow pages. So you go anywhere you want to go to treatment, but you got to go to treatment. And so I'm looking at the yellow pages, and they got a few of these treatment centers in there. And I find this treatment center. I call them on the phone, and I said, I need to come in for a little treatment. And the gal says, well, do you have any insurance? No, don't have. Hadn't worked for 3.5 years, you know. I don't have any insurance. She says, well, it's $12,000. Hell, I don't want to stay all year, you know. I'm not that sick to stay all year, you know. I just need a little treatment. It's very confusing, very frustrating, man. I caught this one place. They wanted $18,000. I couldn't believe it. I was so frustrated. I said, honey, listen, if I had $18,000, I wouldn't need your goddamn treatment. Really true. Solve any problem I had. But finally called this one place, and I said, I need to come in for a little treatment. So the gal says, okay. And I said, well, now listen, you need to know something. I don't have any insurance. She says, oh, okay. And I said, well, how much is it? She's a salesperson. So she says, well, when you check in here, you get room, you get board, and you get therapy, both individual and group therapy, mind you. And it was $9 a day. And then when you check in here, you apply for food stamps. And we credit that food stamps to the bill. And then if you work around here, we pay you $1.50 a day. So that's out to be about $5 a day, something like that. I couldn't believe it. I said, how long is your waiting list? So those other places had 12, 18,000 to get in. They had 30 to 60 day waiting lists. So I asked this place, I said, how long is your waiting list? She said, well, we have a bed for you tonight. Well, I don't really need to come tonight. She says, I think you need to come tonight. Now, I got a problem with this place. Think about it, guys. I mean, they got bargain rates, right? $9 a day, room, board, and therapy. They can't fill their beds, all right? Now they're high-pressuring me to get me to come in down there. Okay? I'm the consumer. I'm right. Okay? So I said, honey, listen, you make my reservation for Saturday. Or just forget the whole damn deal. So she made it. And I didn't drink. I don't know why I didn't drink. Just didn't drink. Saturday came. Drove down there, sat in that parking lot for hours, watching them. You know, watching them go in and out. I wanted to see, you know, what kind of person goes to a $9 a day jitter joint, okay? I'm watching them go in and out of there all day long. And you know what? They were alcoholics. Everybody. I thought, hell, no wonder they're going in there. Look at them. They look like alcoholics. You know? Now, they look like y'all look. Y'all don't look like alcoholics. They look like alcoholics. And I wasn't an alcoholic. Okay? But it fit my budget. So, checked in. I was on Saturday, just filled out a bunch of papers, nothing happened. Sunday, I had my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous. Two guys from outside came in. We sat along tables like this. And we're sitting back. I'm sitting back there being very quiet. That's the way I do it, you know. Get real quiet, sit in the back, try to figure out how we're supposed to act. See, because if I can figure out how we're supposed to do this, then I can go do AA. I'm a real chameleon. We've talked about that. Other speakers talked about that. Real chameleon, you know. Got to figure out what we're doing, and I'll just blend, you know. So I'm being real quiet, watching what we do. These two guys from outside talked for a long time, and then I didn't hear a damn thing they said because I'm watching what everybody else does. You know? Then they started down the rows. It was a discussion meeting. So the first guy introduced himself, said, "My name is Joe B. I'm an alcoholic, and I'll pass." Second guy said, "My name's Jim S. I'm an alcoholic, and I'll pass." What? Hell, I caught on real quick, okay? What they do in AA, see? You give your first name, last initial, admit to the group you're alcoholic, and then you pass. You know, something magical about that. If you can just admit to the group that you're an alcoholic, it's you just take that burden of alcoholism off your shoulders. They had it on the wall. That's got to be it. You know, admitted you were powerless over alcohol. So I thought, that's what you do here. So it came to me. I did it right. My name is John A. I'm an alcoholic, and I'll pass. Nothing happened. Not a damn thing happened. I thought, well, I guess AA's for the simple-minded people, you know? Nobody that's been to college and with any brains around here. Just for simple, uneducated, hardcore alcoholics. Not for guys like me that may or may not have a touch of alcoholism. Now, as distorted a perception as that is of Alcoholics Anonymous, that was my perception of Alcoholics Anonymous. Monday came, got to meet my counselor, Dale. Dale's a lovely lady. Where she's interviewing me, and we're going through all this stuff, and she wanted me to stay 2 months. I said, Dale. I have been here all weekend, okay? They've told me, I've talked to these people, they're alcoholics. They've told me they're alcoholics. I got no reason to doubt it. They look like they probably are alcoholics. I said, I don't know whether I'm alcoholic or not. I think I have a touch of alcoholism. But they told me how that first month, you could spend first month, man, breaking me down, you know, getting me to be open and honest. Let me save a month right there. All right. I've always been open and honest in everything that I do. And I've got a great mind. I mean, I read real fast. I did great in school. I got a memory a photographic memory, I guess. Scary as hell. I remember everything I read. And I did real well. And I'm too busy to stay that long. She said, "You're too busy?" I said, "Oh, yeah. I'm too busy." She said, "Where are you working?" I said, "Well, I'm not working, but I'm too busy." You know? Isn't that true about us? Aren't we busy people? I want to tell you, alcoholics are the most busy, unemployed people you ever want to meet in your life. I don't know what we do, but we're busy doing it, you know. You watch them. Go to your group tomorrow. Go to your home group tomorrow, right? Now, it's Monday. Okay? The guy's unemployed. He's got nothing to do all day long but get to a meeting, and he's late. And you say, "Where you been?" "Hell, I've been busy." You know? I don't know what we do, but we're busy doing it, you know. We really are. And I said, "So, Dale, I'll tell you what, I'll give you 2 weeks. Okay, I'll give you 2 weeks because then I got to get back to Reno. See, because I'm not really going to quit drinking. That's not my deal. I'm just doing this to get out of jail. And I figure treatment time is better than jail time. You know, and I figure 2 weeks will fulfill my commitment to stand. And then I can get back to Reno and get on with my life. Okay? So I said, "Yeah, I'll give you 2 weeks. So you give me whatever material you're going to study during that, you know, that two-month period. I'll read ahead. You can give me some pop quizzes if you want, because 2 weeks I'm out of here." She listened to all that stuff. She says, "We'd better hurry with you." Damn right. Damn right, you better hurry. That was on Monday. Tuesday, got to go to group. Group therapy. Got to love groups. Anybody been to group? Don't you love group? I love group, man. You sit around in a circle, right, facing each other. Talk about their family. I love that kind of stuff. I love it. And you can interrupt. You cross-talking's permitted. Yeah. Oh, come on, man. Get honest. I got to love it. You know that group lingo? Well, oh, man, you're in denial. Love that kind of shit, you know. Can't see much good come from it, but it's fun to do, you know. Good way to spend an hour when you're in treatment. That was on Tuesday. Wednesday, alcoholic education seminar. Well, they're showing us a movie about alcoholism. And I'm bored with movies about alcoholism and drug addiction. I don't even watch. Even today, I'm bored with them. I don't watch them. So I'm sitting there prepared to not like this movie. And the name of the movie was I'll Quit Tomorrow. And I'm sitting there, and all my ego and all my contempt prepared not like this movie. Man, the movie tore me apart. It tore me apart. I related to everything that went on in that movie. I related to it all. I mean, I did everything that guy did. I talked the way he talked. I thought the way he thought. I acted the way he acted. I drank the way he drank. I did everything that guy did. You know? I related to the whole thing. That was my moment of clarity when I knew the gig was up. You know? I knew the gig was up. I related to it all. What happened to me that night is I quit looking for that definition. What's an alcoholic? How do you know you're an alcoholic? What is an alcoholic? Quit looking for that definition. See, I later found out in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't have a definition of an alcoholic. We don't have one. I couldn't define an alcoholic for you this morning. I don't know how to define that. What we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is a description. See, you can't argue with the description. You can argue with the definition. That's why Webster's got 10 definitions for every word, right? But you can't argue with the description. The most powerful tool God has given Alcoholics Anonymous is our description of the alcoholic. Because it's that description that seems to have the power to literally strip everything that separates the alcoholic from himself. And I could see me that day like I'd never seen me. I could see me that day like my mom saw me. I could see me that day like my ex-wife saw me. The difference was I could see me as I related to it. And I knew the gig was up. It was my moment of clarity. It's the most powerful tool. Think how important our description of the alcoholic is. I mean, two-thirds of our book, two-thirds of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is descriptions of alcoholics in the stories. I mean, why did they put all those stories in there? Just to make a big book? You know? No, it's that important. And if you're only reading the first 164 pages, you ain't reading the book. You know? Because it's that description of the alcoholic that seems to have that power to literally strip everything that separates the alcoholic from himself. And I could see me that night like I'd never see me. And I wasn't happy about it. It wasn't a relief saying, oh, thank God I know what's wrong with me. I was petrified. I was totally scared to death. Because now what do I do? I know I'm an alcoholic. How on earth am I going to function without drinking? That means I got to go get a job because I can't continue to run my little deals. I mean, you know, how am I going to date? How am I going to dance? How am I going to have to go out to dinner and not drink? I can't live. I knew the gig was up, and stayed in that place 6 weeks. Couldn't stay 2 months. Too busy to stay 2 months. But I got out of there the first December, and they told me when I was getting out of there, they said, now, John, you need aftercare. You need aftercare. Well, you're living in Reno. We're in Salt Lake. That's too far to go for aftercare. Twice a week or three times a week. So your aftercare is you go to AA. That'll be your aftercare program. You go to AA. So I drove back to Reno, and I knew two things when I got back to Reno. Okay? I knew I was an alcoholic, and I didn't want to drink. And I also knew AA had enough to offer. Okay? And, I mean, because look, you go there, you give your first name, last initial, admit you're an alcoholic, and then pass. Okay? I already knew that. I didn't need to do that. You know? But I didn't want to drink. So the first time back in town, I call Alcoholics Anonymous. I told the guy, I said, my name is John A., and I'm an alcoholic. And the guy said, well, I'm Bruce. I'm alcoholic. There's an inner group. And I said, well, Bruce, I said, listen, I just got out of treatment over here in Salt Lake and live here in Reno, and I wanted to, you know, call and report in. I think they had me on computer, you know. If you don't show up, they put out a warrant on your deal. He says, well, I'm glad you're here. He said, you want to go to a meeting tonight? I said, yeah, I'd go to a meeting tonight. You know, you'll probably want to meet me. And he said, well, I'm not going tonight. But there's a meeting. He said, it starts at 8:30 at the third floor of the Riverside Casino. It's a Sierra room down there. So go to the third floor, find a Sierra room of the Riverside Casino, and that's where the meeting is. Men's stag meeting. I said, okay, I'll be there so that we can meet. He said, I'm not going. I said, well, then, you know, call them and let them know that I'm coming. He said, they'll be there. So I show up 8:15. First resentment, Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I called, told them I'm coming. Okay. No, nobody knew I was coming. Okay, no reception. Nobody said, oh, you must be the John A. just out of treatment. I'm sorry. Here's your seat. Here's your coffee. No. There's some guy smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, waiting for a meeting. I got my coffee, sat down. Pretty soon, an old guy named Red started chair the meeting. Red looked like an alcoholic. He really did. And he talked for a while, and then they started down these rows. There's a discussion meeting. This men's stag meeting. These guys talked. Now, I don't know what they were talking about. Okay? It's nothing we talked about in treatment at all. And they didn't even do that right. Okay? I'm sitting there in that meeting, and some of these guys, when they introduced themselves, did not give their last initial. They just said, my name's John, I'm an alcoholic. I thought, geez, the guy didn't even know how to give his last initial. You know? Some of them gave their last name. I'm so embarrassed for the guy. He's not even anonymous anymore. I mean, Jesus. I could look him up in the phone book if I wanted to. They talked about stuff. I don't know what it was, you know. Nothing we talked about. I couldn't believe it, man. Halfway through that meeting, nobody had mentioned we got an XY chromosome deficiency. For heaven's sakes, how are they going to stay sober not knowing that? Okay? So it got around to me. I thought I'd help. And I did it right, too. I said, my name is John A., and I'm an alcoholic. And then I qualified. I said, listen, I just got out of treatment over here in Salt Lake City. And I want you to know I have the latest, most up-to-date medical and psychological information on the disease. Red cut me off, said, thank you, John. Went on the next guy. That son of a bitch is jealous. I mean, I know stuff he don't know. That's his problem, you know. My first resentment, Alcoholics Anonymous. After the meeting, some guys came up and shook my hand and said, hope you come back. I thought, shit, I'll be back. They need me. You know? Now, Chuck Chamberlain says, every man's my teacher. Some people teach me what to do. Some people teach me what not to do. Okay? Please keep in mind, most of what I share from the podium is what not to do. Okay? Because I've done this deal all wrong. All wrong. I don't know where I was when they said 90 meetings in 90 days. It's not the way I did it. Okay. What I did is I did one meeting a week. Every Thursday I go down to my men's stag meeting. Okay. Every Thursday I'm down to stag meeting. Now they will not let me share down there. Okay. But I keep going back because I figure I'm a hell of a lot younger than Red. He's going to die, then I get to share. Down there. Now let me tell you what happens when you go to one meeting a week if you haven't tried that. Okay. They told me in treatment, this is one truism they told me in treatment. They said, John, don't drink. Man, if you don't drink, you're going to feel better. Just don't drink, you'll feel better. And that's true. But see, they never explained to me what that meant. If you don't drink, you'll feel better. You're going to feel all the pain, all the anger, all the resentment. You're going to feel that shit a whole lot better. Okay? I mean, I drink when I feel better, right? I don't want to feel nice. So I'm walking around Reno feeling better, going nuts. I mean, surprised, like watching paint dry. God damn, it's boring and long. Thursday, we get to go down to men's fag meeting and not share again. And I got so much to contribute to. I was down there at the men's stag meeting. It was Christmas Eve. So that Thursday fell on Christmas Eve, and they announced at the men's stag meeting, they said, well, now, tomorrow is Christmas Day. Okay, you got nowhere to go for Christmas. They're having Christmas dinner free over at the Dryers Club, Skid Row Clubhouse over on Wells Street in Reno. You can go over there, you got nowhere to go and have Christmas dinner. Well, I had nowhere to go. So I went over there to the Dryers Club on Christmas, and I ate, and it was good, and I'm drinking a cup of coffee, smoking a cigarette. Here comes a guy. Okay, you can see, you know, when you see him, they start walking across the room to you, looking at you. Here he comes, and he's not my kind of guy. No, he's an old guy. Fat old guy. Big nose, real funny hair. Nothing hip, slick, and cool about the guy at all. Not my kind of guy. Okay? He come over and started talking to me. His name was Don. He's a coordinator of intergroup. So I'm talking to Don, and after just a few minutes talking to Don, it became clear. Don had not been to treatment. Okay? So I started to tell Don about all the stuff they were not letting me talk about in my home group. Okay? He gets a funny look on his face. He says, you want to go to a meeting tonight? I said, hell, Don, it's Friday. I go Thursday, so over to men's stag group. He said, we got a meeting every night in Reno. And I'd heard, in that month I'd been going to AA, I'd heard something about this was a spiritual program, right? So I thought, okay, spiritual program, right? It's Christmas. Spiritual program. I can go twice this week. Won't hurt. You know? So here this guy don't like comes, gets me, takes me out to the state hospital. He got a meeting out there at 7 o'clock on Friday. So we got to the state hospital. We get out there, and I love it, man, because when you walk in there, they give you a raffle ticket. They give you the raffle ticket. And at the end of the meeting, they raffle off a big book or as Bill sees it. So I got my raffle ticket, walked in. There were women in the meeting. First meeting I've been to with women in the meeting. I didn't know they let them in. Okay. Now, I'd been to a men's dry-out joint. I'd been to a men's stag meeting. I figured it was a man's deal. You know, I didn't know they let women in that thing. Women in the meeting. Amelia adopted that as my home group. Why on earth have I been going to the men's stag meeting when I can come over here? This is incredible stuff, you know. So I sat down. They had some discussion. I don't know what they talked about because I'm busy praying, okay? This is it, man. Because although I have a great mind and I read real good, you know, okay, I had forgot to get a big book. And I thought, this is it, man. I'm going to win the big book. I'm probably the only guy in this meeting tonight without a big book. I'm going to win the book. So I'm praying for my book. By the time that meeting's over, I want to tell you, God can give that book to nobody but me. I mean, nobody's been praying like I've been praying for the book. I want it. Mine. So at the end of the meeting, they had the raffle off the big book. My second resentment, Alcoholics Anonymous. Some little gray-haired lady, 25 years sober, wins my book. What she need my book for Pete's sake? You know, she got 25 years. Can't see to read. So old, you know. She got five of them at home probably collecting dust. When's my book? So I'm storming out of there. Before I get out of there, that little lady comes up and gives me that book. That's where I got my book. And I took her home that night. And, okay, I used to say I took her home that night and I read it from cover to cover. Okay? So if you ever heard me say that, or if you ever get hold of an old tape where I said that, then please believe that when I said that, hell, I believed it. You know? Then I got involved in a big book study. You wouldn't believe the chapters in that book. It's incredible. They got a chapter in the book called, you know, Chapter to the Wives. Well, I wasn't a wife, didn't have a wife, didn't want a wife. Okay? Didn't read that chapter. Okay? They got a chapter in the book called Chapter to the Employer. Hell, I'm not an employee. Okay? Didn't read that chapter. They got one called We Agnostics. Okay, well, I wasn't agnostic. I knew God. Didn't read that chapter. Okay? Well, I want to tell you, if you just read, you know, chapter 3 and chapter 5, you can read that book in the night. Won't take you that long. It really won't. Next day, this guy calls me on the phone, takes me to the meeting. Every day, this guy's calling me on the phone, and I don't want to go. I don't want to go. But he didn't ask if I want to go. He calls me up and says, I'll pick you up in 20 minutes. Quick, hang up. You know? And I can't stand him up. He's the only guy talking to me in AA. If I cut him off, I'm screwed, you know? I don't know what his power structure is in the organization. Maybe he'll not let me go. And so I hang around waiting for Don to come pick me up. You know, we go off to the meeting. And I'll be eternally grateful to Don for that. Eternally. I don't know how I could ever pay him back. You know, a lot of times in Alcoholics Anonymous, we'll see somebody come to a meeting. You know, they'll be around for a month or two. And then we'll be sitting there having coffee, and then somebody will bring up and say, hey, you remember that little Joe? Curly-haired, dark-haired Joe. What about little Joe? And somebody else will pipe up and say, hey, listen, man, Joe knows where we are. If he wants it, let him come get it. All right? Well, I'm glad Don didn't believe that nonsense. I'm glad Don understood. I'm glad he understood that the very first 12-step call, think about that. The only reason we're here tonight or this morning is because the sober alcoholic called the drunk. Dr. Bob was sober. Bill Wilson didn't call Dr. Bob. You know, Dr. Bob called Bill. See, sometimes when we're new, we don't know. You can say 90 meetings in 90 days. I never heard that. You know? Sometimes we needed somebody to come get us. And Don loved his sobriety enough and loved Alcoholics Anonymous enough to come get an arrogant kid and take him to a meeting. If he hadn't done that, you'd have a different speaker this morning. I had maybe another 30 days before I was gone. But he'd come get me, take me to a meeting till I could hear for myself. You know? And it was an incredible thing. All of a sudden, things started to change. Now, at that time, I didn't have a sponsor. I hadn't worked any steps. The only thing I was doing different is I was going to a meeting every day. Don would come by and take me to a meeting. He's a coordinator of intergroup, so I started hanging out in intergroup, meeting other alcoholics, going to a meeting that night. So the only thing I was doing different is going to a meeting. And an interesting thing happened. I not only started to feel better, but I started to feel good. And I hadn't felt those two things at the same time in years. And I was down in intergroup, and it was exciting, man. Sobriety started to get kind of fun. And I could not believe that it would be fun to go to coffee after the meeting. You know, but it was kind of exciting and fun. I'm meeting other alcoholics. And I'm down in intergroup during the day. I'm talking to them, getting ready. And it was a week later, Thursday, it was New Year's Eve. I'm going to go to my men's stag meeting New Year's Eve. I'm excited about going on New Year's Eve to an AA meeting. Insane. That's what that is. But I'm excited about it. And I'm down to intergroup. The phone rings. New Year's Eve. I grab the phone. This young kid named Glenn. Glenn was 17 years old. I want to know how to stay sober New Year's Eve. I said, why? I mean, God, Glenn, you're 17. It's New Year's Eve, you know? They may stay out there one more night, you know. Call tomorrow. We'll be here. No problem. My surgery's imminent. Don grabs that phone away from me. That's when he passed the rule of central office. You had to have 6 months or more sobriety to answer the phone. I got mad. I went to get coffee. Don talked to him. I don't know what he said. Gave him his phone number. Did not give him my phone number. Next day, Don calls me up. Says, hey, Glenn stayed sober last night, wants to go to a meeting today. Great. 12-step work, you know. So Don comes get me. We go get Glenn, take Glenn out to the state hospital. He's driving in there. And then it dawned on me, damn it, Don does not know how to make a 12-step call. Okay? Because he's just driving to the meeting. He's not saying a word, you know. So now I got to carry the burden of 12-stepping this guy. So I start telling Glenn all about Alcoholics Anonymous. I say, Glenn, you wouldn't believe this, man. When you go there, they're gonna be women at your first meeting. You know, you're gonna love this. You know, there's gonna be women there. You're gonna want to come back every Friday night to do this, Glenn, and you're gonna love it. And then when you get there, Glenn, give you a raffle ticket. And does that mean they raffle off a big book or Bill sees or something like that? And, you know, and if God loves you, you'll probably win the book. Don doesn't say where. Don just drove to the meeting, you know. So we get to the meeting, we get our raffle tickets, we sit down and with our coffee, and they had some meeting, I don't know what they talked about, because I'm busy praying for Glenn. Man, if Glenn can just win that book, that'll be proof to him God's working in his life. He'll stay sober forever. Not that it really matters, okay, but, you know, I would have 100% 12-step call success rate. So he's got to win that book. So I'm busy praying for Glenn to win that book. At the end of that meeting, went to have the raffle off the big book. I won the big book. Don turns to me and says, see how it works? I said, yeah, I signed it, gave it to Glenn. That's where Glenn got his big book. Okay, he's sober today, by the way. Because I gave him that book. That's all. Now, that little experience early in my sobriety taught me a lot. Okay, because it taught me how God works. Because God works through people. God works through people. See? By working through people, it's a win-win situation. Always two winners when God works. It's a win-win deal when God works. See, I could have won the big book that first night. There had been one winner, me. But that little old lady won by being able to share with me, and I won by being able to receive from her. Okay? Two winners when God works. See, by working through people, he gets twice the result for the same effort. He works through people. A week later, two winners. I won by being able to share with Glenn, and Glenn won by being able to receive from me. God works through people. It also taught me how Alcoholics Anonymous works. See, because Alcoholics Anonymous is one drunk sharing with another. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. One drunk sharing. And when that happens, man, that's the magic. And there are always two winners. The drunk doing the sharing and the drunk doing the receiving. Okay? I've told that story hundreds and hundreds of times in the 16 years I've been in the fellowship. And whenever I tell that story, I remember that moment when I knew the gig was up. I'm convinced that everyone in this room tonight that's sober in Alcoholics Anonymous had that moment of clarity when you knew the gig was up. I'm as equally convinced that those that come to AA for a while and leave and are out there drinking and dying today had that moment when they knew the gig was up. Because see, that moment normally happens before you get to AA. That's God's gift. I mean, think about that. I'm willing to bet 24 hours for your last drink, you didn't know it was going to be your last drink. The most important decision you ever made in your life, you didn't give a thought to 24 hours before it happened. But something happened. That moment of clarity. And those that leave and are out there drinking, dying tonight had that moment of clarity. What's the difference then between those of us that have stayed here and are sober, and those that are out there drinking and dying? We both had that moment. I think what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous is really pretty simple. What we do in here is we keep that moment alive. We keep it alive. See, as I've shared my moment with you of what it was like and what happened, we keep it alive. I remember like it happened yesterday. And what have you related to? And what have you thought about as you related to it? And when I'm on that side of the podium, and one of y'all is up here, and you're keeping your moment alive by sharing with us what it was like and what happened, what am I thinking about? By the way, isn't this the perfect recovery program for people whose root problem is they're selfish, self-centered? Because when you're up here remembering your moment, I'm so self-centered, what am I thinking about? My moment, yeah. Screw that, I did it worse, you know. We keep it alive, and nowhere can you keep that moment alive but when one drunk shares with another. Then that's a win-win deal. You can't keep your moment alive by sharing it with your shrink. It doesn't work. That's not a win-win deal. He doesn't need to hear it.
I need to hear it. You can't keep it alive by sharing it with your priest. They don't need to hear it. That's a win deal. It's not a win-win deal. I need to hear it. It only happens when one drunk shares with another. It's an incredible deal. And I want to tell you, if you lose your moment, you take drunk. You take drunk. But when one drunk shares with another, it's an incredible thing that goes on. And we can't explain it. We don't know how that works, but it does. It always works. And that's where all the miracles and tremendous things go on, is when one drunk shares with another. And there are always two winners when that happens. It's a win-win deal. And my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous has been nothing short of a miracle from the day I got here, as yours has, till this very moment. And it's all been through God working with people and one drunk sharing with another. I was living in there in Reno until 83. I moved to Dallas in 83. And my whole life fell together in Dallas. I got back in the insurance business in Dallas. And I got married in Dallas. I got divorced in Dallas. You know? And I tell you, that's an interesting thing, you know? It was very painful going through that. And really painful. And I was in a lot of pain, and I was questioning myself, and I was questioning my stuff, and I'm working with my sponsor, and they say, okay, when all else fails, work with other alcoholics, right? So I started going to a lot of meetings and passing my business card out to a lot of newcomers, giving them my business cards, and I started to sponsor a lot of guys that were new. And they would call me up. And they would call me on the phone. They were just coming out of these treatment centers and stuff. And at that time, it was right at the peak of treatment mania, you know? And so they were all coming in. They had all these books and these literatures. And they would come in and say, I need to get schedule some time with you when I can cover some of my issues. And I had never heard that. We weren't that developed in my treatment program. And I said, what kind of issues are you talking about? He said, well, if you're going to help me, you need to understand, John, that I really come from a very dysfunctional family. And because of that, I have an abandonment issue that I've never been able to resolve. And that has led to difficulties in me learning to set boundaries. And because of that, it's generated a real sex addiction that totally out of control. And these are just some of the issues that I need to cover with you. Man, I'm listening to that, and I think, wow, I'm way over my head in this deal. So they come over to the house, and they give you these books. Because I know what they're talking about. They say, well, you need to get current on the modern trends of recovery. So they give me these things, and I read. I want to tell you, you want to read that stuff? You know what will happen? You'll relate. I want to promise you, you will relate. Okay? Why? Because what is happening is that they are compartmentalizing aspects of alcoholism. That's what's going on. All the related disorders are being compartmentalized of alcoholism. So no wonder you relate. They're describing what you are. But what are they doing? They're defining what that is. And I'm relating to that, and they're doing some new drug therapy, and they're doing this other therapy, and I'm getting sick, and I'm not getting any better. I'm feeling worse, and they're going out drinking occasionally, and I'm getting worse. And I was so screwed up and messed after about 6 months. I went to my sponsor, and I said, my program is not working. It is not, my program is not working. And he looked at me and said, well, why don't you try ours? And then he said, how many guys you sponsor? I said, new? He said, yeah, new guys, under a year. I said, 14. Any of them getting well? No, I'm getting sick. And then he asked me a key question. He said, John, he said, let me ask you, are you passing on to them the same simple program of Alcoholics Anonymous that was passed on to you? And I wasn't. And I had to go back to those guys and make amends, knowing that most of them would go elsewhere to find sponsorship. Because, see, that's what I'm responsible for. It's passing on the same simple program of Alcoholics Anonymous that was passed on to me. Okay? And after you've been so kind to write me up and treat us so well up here, I don't want anybody to leave and not know that simple program that was passed on to me, because that's what I need. That's what I'm responsible for. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that was passed on to me doesn't say anything that I have to learn to deal with, I have to learn to cope, or I have to learn to manage any issues. We don't do that in AA. That's not what goes on in here. Okay? I'm sorry. You know, if you think it is, but it's not. And I would be doing you a very big disservice if I didn't let you know that. We don't do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't learn to manage, deal, or cope with any issues. Okay? If I could have done that, I would have done it 17 years ago. And you'd have a different speaker. What happens in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the main purpose of the book, is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. That's what we do in here. That's what goes on in here. We don't know when that's going to happen. We don't know how it's going to happen. But we know that if you take certain steps, it will happen. That's what we know. If you will do these things, then this will happen. If you do anything else, and you don't do these things, that ain't going to happen. I can promise you, that ain't going to happen. And what is that? Finding a power greater than yourself that will solve all your problems. That's all that goes on in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he does it through people. Because God works through people. Now, that all applies, and it only applies if you believe that. If you believe that God truly does love you, and that he personally is concerned about you personally. And he's going to take care of you. As the third step says, he'll take care of you. If you believe that, great. But maybe that's not right. Maybe there's a God. Maybe he created us. But to be personally involved in my life, I don't think so. You know, I mean, that's a big, there's a lot of people in the world, you know. That ain't going to happen. Let's get real. I need to do something myself. I need to take control of my life and take control of my recovery. I'm responsible for my recovery, right? I want to tell you something. I'm responsible to suit up and show up. And I'm responsible to become willing to let God take care of me. When that happens, I mean, I'm sitting there in a room, in a meeting of my home group. Dallas North's my home group at that time. I'm up there, this is years ago, and it was birthday night. 200 people at that birthday party. Big, big party. 200 people there. After the birthday party, I'm getting ready to leave and go home. And Joanne's working the front desk. Joanne comes up, she gives me this 12-step call. She says, this little lady called from San Antonio. Okay? And her son is suicidal. He's living up here in Dallas. And he called his mama and asked his mama to call AA. Because he's going to kill himself. And she called information and asked for AA. And they gave her Dallas North's phone number. And she said, well, you want to take this 12-step call? And I said, well, I want to talk to her first. So I called her on the phone, and I told her who it was, and she started crying. She said, listen, she says, my son's been drinking and drugging for 2 weeks, and he's real confused, and he's real screwed up, and he's suicidal, and he's got a gun. And he called me and asked me to call AA, because he can't find their phone number. He's so disoriented. Can you go by and help my son? And I said, yeah, let me have this phone number, so I called him on the phone. I told him who I was. I said, you want some help? He started crying. I said, yeah, I want some help. He said, I had to call you. He said, because I know I'm supposed to call. I'd been to AA, but I don't know. I just couldn't. I could remember Mom's number, call her, and ask her to call you. And I said, what's your address? We'll come see you tonight. And then he got scared and confused, and he said, man, he said, I don't know how to tell you to get here. My address won't do you any good. I live on a little street that's two blocks long. You'll never be able to find me. It's just, no, I might as well just end it, because that ain't going to work. And I said, give me your address. We'll find you. So he gave me his address, and he lives on a street called Dome Street. Okay? Now, Dome Street's a little street, two blocks long. You also need to know that I told this story for about 10 years in Dallas, Texas, every month when I was doing the steps in one of the groups. And I'd tell them this story about Dome Street. And every month I asked the room full of alcoholics, does anybody know where Dome Street is? I never once in 10 years had an alcoholic say, I know where Dome Street is. That's thousands of alcoholics I ask over a 10-year period. If anybody knows where Dome Street is, nobody knows where Dome Street is. Okay? But see, I know where Dome Street is. I know right where. I have a client that happened to live on Dome Street. In fact, he not only lives on Dome Street, he is literally the next-door neighbor of the guy making the phone call. I said, I know right where you are. I'll come get you. Grab the guy's sponsor, we went out to get that. Yeah. Nah, it's just a coincidence, isn't it? God doesn't love us that much, does he? He's not going to put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information in our lives to help us, is he? That's just a coincidence. I wouldn't worry about that. That's a freaky deal, you know? That's a freaky deal. You know the odds of that? The odds of a lady in San Antonio calling information in Dallas, Texas, asking for an AA group. We got, what do we got there, Otto? 150 groups in the Metroplex area, and they pick Dallas North. There's 200 people in Dallas North that night, and Joanne picks me to give the 12-step call to, and I know where Dome Street is. You know the odds of that? I'm a gambler, right? Oh, yeah, I want to bet on that. That'll work. That'll work all the time. It's like a few years after I'm getting ready to go on an airplane out to California, right? I've got plane left at 9 o'clock. I get out there at 8 o'clock. And there's a big sign up there saying this plane's been delayed an hour. Well, that's no problem. I don't need to be there till 1. So I get my coffee. I'm reading the newspaper. And they come back at 9 o'clock and they say, this flight's been canceled. We can't fix the plane. Flight's been canceled. But there's a plane leaving two gates down that's going to California. And there's some standby only on it. 17 seats. Well, you know, 100 of us run down there. We get on standby. And we get our name on the list. I'm the second to the last guy they call on standby. So I get on the plane, I'm going back to, this is when you can smoke on planes. There's one seat left in the smoking section, right next to the window, and right next to that seat, boy, this good-looking gal in a red dress. Never forget that red dress. God is working in my life today. I sit down in the seat, and it's a bad seat, man, because she's a chatterbox. Bop, 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 bop. Just, I have not had enough coffee yet for this woman, you know, so she's chattering away. Finally, the plane takes off. She shuts up. She pulls out a needlepoint. She's needlepointing. I glance down. I see she's needlepointing the Serenity Prayer. My turn. So I said, what are you needlepointing? And she's embarrassed. You know, she's old enough to know she's needlepointing. I said, you are too. What is that you're needlepointing? So she holds. She says, well, they call it the Serenity Prayer. I said, oh, man. Are you one of those Jesus freaks? She said, no. Now she's real busy. She's nervous. She's, but I'm trying to lead a spiritual life. I said, really? She said, yeah, she's needlepoint. I'm watching her. She can tell I'm watching her, so her hands are sweating and she's nervous. You know? I said, man, you're doing that fast. She said, oh, I know, I shouldn't do this. I said, why? Well, my mama told me not. I got a compulsive personality. I said, no kidding. She's needlepoint in there. I finally thought, I better stop this poor gal before she breaks a finger. I said, honey, wait a minute. Listen, if that's the Serenity Prayer, and you're trying to lead the spiritual life, you got that compulsive personality. I said, you must be a friend of Bill Wilson's. And boy, she sighed, she stopped, sighed, and she said, yes, I am. Are you? I said, no. She gets a funny look on her face, you know. I said, he died years before I got sober, you know. That's all there is to it, you know. So. Come to find out, this poor gal had 2 years sober. This was her first trip away from Dallas in sobriety. She was going out to California for 2 weeks and was scared to death. She had also had her first drunk dream the night before, didn't know what all that meant. was petrified, never got time to talk to her sponsor because she was running late. And so we had a great 3-hour meeting on that airplane, you know. We cried a little bit, laughed a little bit. I gave her some names of some people out in California I know, and I told her about some of my drunk dreams. She said to me, she said, "Can you believe what God has done for me?" She said, "I was sitting up there in the non-smoking section because I've been trying to quit smoking, but then when they told me they were going to let you people on, we could move if we wanted to before you got on, I was so nervous, I moved back here. Can you believe that God would have me move back here just to sit by you?" I said, "Oh, honey, hell. He camped my whole plane to get me to come over here sit by you." You know? You know, I'm just simple enough to believe that. You know? That's just a coincidence, you know. God doesn't love us that much. Come on. Already you're way off base on that. You know, he doesn't love us that. He's not going to do that. He's not going to put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information in our lives to help us, is he? No. He doesn't love us that much. That ain't going to happen. It's just a coincidence. December 1990. I was at a little conference, the border conference they call us, in Del Rio, Texas. Small conference. About 100 people attended. And I'm down there Saturday, I meet this gal. And she got on her name badge, it's called, her name's Dottie, middle initial, last initial E, and underneath it she's got written Connecticut. I said, "Dottie, what are you doing in Del Rio, Texas from Connecticut, for Pete's sake?" And she said, "Well, I'm on my way to see my husband. He's in the Navy in San Diego. And we spent the night here last night, and I was going to go, we were going to drive on in today." And I told the kids, I said, "You know, I'm too tired. Let's just stay here in Del Rio. I mean, that's the place I'd want to stay, you know. Let's just stay here in Del Rio and relax for the day." And I called AA, and I told them about this conference. She had been sober 6 years, and so I came to the conference. And I said, "Well, great. Welcome to Texas." So I spoke Saturday night afternoon. Dottie comes up to me, and she said, heard my story. She said, "You grew up in Utah." I said, "Yeah." She said, "Well, do you have any relatives in Orem, Utah?" I said, "Yeah, I grew up in Orem, Utah." And she said, "Well, are you related to Mark and Betty Joe?" I said, "Well, they're my parents." You know? And then Dottie starts to cry and throws her arms around me. She tells me what her last name is. She says, "I'm married to Bobby." And see, Bobby's my first cousin. We're 3 days apart in age. We grew up together, ripping and running. And then when we turned 18, Bobby joined the Navy, and I went to college. And I hadn't seen Bobby in 18 years. We wrote for the first couple of years, and then we just never lost touch. And Bobby had met Dottie in Alcoholics Anonymous when he was new sober and she was new sober, and they got married. I didn't even know that. You know, and she was on her way to see Bobby to serve him with divorce papers. Because, see, Bobby got drunk after 2 years. He was drunk that night. Went up to my room and called, and Bobby was drunk that night. And he had a real problem with God, and he had a real problem with Alcoholics Anonymous. And that opened up a little door for me to be able to give some service and 12-step him. And you know where Bobby is today? I know where Bobby is right now. See, Bobby's in Russia this week, and he's on an AA tour where, you know, they take those tours over to Russia. Bobby's coming up on 6 years sober. You know? That's just a coincidence, isn't it? God doesn't love us that much. He's not going to put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information in our lives to help us. You know the odds of that? She lives in Connecticut. He's in San Diego. I live in Dallas. And we meet in Del Rio. You know? Well, I've never met her because she just decided to spend the day in Del Rio. You know? After 18 years, I meet a gal I've never, was married to my first cousin I've never met. That's just coincidence, isn't it? God doesn't love us that much to put just the right person with just the right time with just the right information in our lives to help us. A couple years ago, right now, I was over in Hawaii. They'd invited me to come over to the Hawaii State Convention, and the day I got there, my father died. He lives in Salt Lake, and it was a mess getting off the island, and I couldn't get off the island until Saturday, and we got off the island Saturday, and I had to fly a real funny way to get there, because there were all the books, the flights were booked. I had to go from Hawaii to San Francisco. I had a 4.5 layover in San Francisco, and then I had to go back to Dallas, from Dallas over to Houston, from Houston back to Salt Lake. You know, it was a really weird deal. It took me 24 hours to make that trip. And I got there Sunday, and we buried him Saturday. And had to go back to the office on Tuesday. So my son took me to the airport. He lives in Salt Lake. Dropped me off Tuesday, and I was tired. I'd been up, and I was really tired. And he dropped me off at the airport about 12:30 in the afternoon, and then he left because he had to go to work. That was really the first time I'd had any time alone, and any time where I wasn't running to do something. And so I'm sitting there in Salt Lake City Airport, and I started into that pit, you know? And I started to go through some guilt, like, John, what in the hell were you thinking? Why were you over in Hawaii when your dad died? You know? You knew he'd been sick. Maybe you shouldn't have been so goddamn selfish, and you should have gone to Utah instead of Hawaii. And I started into all that guilt and all that remorse and crap. And it's about 12:40 in Salt Lake City Airport. And over the PA system, they come on and they say, will a friend of Bill W. pick up the light paging phone? I started laughing at that dumb son of a bitch thinks he needs the 12-step call. You know? I grabbed the phone and I met this guy from Chicago. And we had a great 2-hour meeting before my plane left, and his plane left just shortly after mine. It was a great meeting. Got me right out of self, you know. And it also let me know that I was doing what I was supposed to be doing. You know? That's just a coincidence. And I'm sure all of you have heard many pages in the airport for a friend of Bill W. to pick up the white paging phone. That's just a coincidence, isn't it? God doesn't love us that much. He's not going to put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information in our lives to help us, is he? It's just a coincidence. And I share that tonight because I know that in this meeting this morning, there are some people in this meeting that are in a ton of pain. And it doesn't really seem to matter whether you're 30 days sober or 16 years sober. Sometimes you don't know. It's like you've crawled over the edge of the precipice and you're looking into the abyss and you don't know. Is there something more I'm supposed to be doing? Does this God deal really work? Or is that just AA podium rhetoric? And if that's where you are today, then you need to know something. I know today more than I ever have that God loves us. That we have literally the only treatment for any disease on earth whose recovery treatment program was designed by God Himself. And if you need to borrow my God till you can find the power of your own that will solve your problem, then do it, because I've borrowed yours a lot. And the God of my understanding today is willing to go to any lengths to see that we make it totally on our side. And I even know how my God's going to help you. He's going to put just the right person at just the right time, with just the right information in your life. And it's an incredible thing that we got here. And it'll happen when one alcoholic works with another. And it'll always happen. And I'm just grateful that you let me come up and share with you this weekend. Thank you.